Thank you very much, Rabbi Brand. Reshus HaBezin, Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, Reshus Mor Da'asra, Rabbi Engel, Reshus Rosh Kol, Rabbi Brand, Reshus Professor Reznikov, and all of the other distinguished guests and participants of the program. It is my honor and privilege to address you today on the subject of, can an ethical Jew be a lawyer? I could simply cut the entire presentation short and say, no, of course not. And we could all go home, and at least for this presentation, and that would be the end of it. But I don't think that the answer is quite as simple as that. Lawyering in general is a profession that is associated to some degree with chicanery and bad behavior. All kinds of lawyer jokes. I don't have to tell those present in the audience. Many of you, I assume, are in fact practicing attorneys. That often we... I say we because I certainly consider myself an active attorney. I'm a member of the bar, practiced law for about 6-7 years at the law firm of Cleary something 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 in New York. Cleary Gottlieb, for those who need the clarification. And and we certainly view ourselves as being part of a profession that does not need to be characterized necessarily as all bad, but at the same time, where we understand that we're constantly attacked and constantly maligned, and there is a sense of a lawyer being a shark, a lawyer being an ambulance chaser, a lawyer resorting to unethical tactics in order to be able to gain a victory for his or her client. And the question is, is there in fact some sort of tension between the practice of ethics and being an attorney? It's interesting, I was recently listening to a CLE lecture on professional responsibility, and the professor who was giving the lecture to attorneys, to educate attorneys about all the rules of professional responsibility, the model rules, whatever lawyers have to know, made a point of beginning his presentation by saying very clearly that he wanted to make it absolutely clear to everybody that this was not a lecture about ethics, because the professional responsibility rules that are governing upon lawyers are not rules of ethics per se. They might be objectively unethical, they might be objectively ethical, but that's completely irrelevant. It's just that lawyers have to know that there are certain rules that as a matter of their professional practice, they are duty-bound to follow. And what he is doing is teaching what those rules are, and nobody should confuse this in any way with ethics. So I don't think that his point that he was making is that you should not make the error of thinking that because there are professional rules that there would be some sort of notion of lawyers being ethical. So he wanted to dispel any such notion from the audience, lest anyone be concerned. But I think he was getting at something else, which is that sometimes it's difficult to discern exactly what the ethical principles are. Because if you are looking at a code, like the model rules of professional conduct, sometimes the rules may be somewhat picayune, and may be a little bit esoteric, and some of it may resemble ethics, like not combining the funds received from a client with your own personal funds. It seems like an ethical proposition. But other rules of professional practice seem more administrative and bureaucratic in nature, and therefore it's not necessarily the definitive ground for a lawyer, particularly one with religious sensibilities, other cultural sensibilities, to receive their grounding in terms of their ethical perspective regarding their professional practice. So what then may be other sources for our ethical grounding as we approach the practice of law? Well, for me, and I guess for many of us here in the audience as well, it's impossible to separate our professional lives from our religious lives, because one who is a serious religious Jew certainly looks at the traditional classical Talmudic texts to inform one's ethical sensibilities, and therefore it is instructive to look at some of those texts in order to gain a better perspective, a better outlook, in order to understand what some of these ethical responsibilities might be. It's interesting that if you look at the classical rabbinic sources, you don't find that lawyers are, or the practice of law, is necessarily pigeonholed as the only area where there might be potential pitfalls. If you look at, for example, the Mishnah in Kiddushin, the Mishnah in Kiddushin, which is the second source, mentions with respect to doctors, Tov Shivarofim LeGehinim, that the best of physicians is destined for Gehinim. Gehinim is kind of a Hebrew word that's used to denote the opposite of heaven. So the Mishnah says that the best of doctors is destined for Gehinim, which sounds like a pretty ringing indictment against doctors. So you might think, okay, so a very fine profession then might be that you go into, like Rabbi Engel, you go into the Rabbanus, you go into the Rabbinate. So then you look at another Mishnah in Maseches Avos says, Saneya Tarabanut, you should hate the practice of being a rabbi. The English translation here is lordliness, but many commentators say, no, you should hate being a rabbi because there are all kinds of pitfalls in terms of being a rabbi, of lording yourself over your congregation. You might get full of yourself, and it's also rife with difficult challenges and pitfalls and attacks, and you're constantly being maligned, and it could really take away from a person's lifeblood. And then finally, we have as part of it this general classification of categories of professions deemed undesirable, you have the Mishnah, which is the first source in Maseches Avos, the ethics of our fathers, quoting Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach. And Yehuda ben Tabai says, "Al tas atzmecha ka'orchei adayonim, whatever you do in life, don't make yourself like a lawyer." So we have, shouldn't be a lawyer. Even if you're a good doctor, you're pretty much finished. And you should stay away from being a rabbi. So every single Jewish boy is going to have to be an accountant. There has to be a certain perspective that these different Mishnayos are teaching us. It can't be that everyone is being told to stay away from being a doctor. Great mitzvah to be a doctor. The Torah tells us that you should heal the sick. It's a special mitzvah. Obviously, that's not being prohibited. Obviously, to be a rabbi, to be a successful and inspirational rabbi of a community where you can uplift the souls and you can prepare the congregation for meaningful lives and for entree to the world to come. This is something which would be undesirable. It can't be. The greatest leaders among the Jewish people have always been rabbis. Must be rather that all these different passages are teaching us something that is sobering and something which gives us a perspective regarding the passage about avoiding being a lawyer, which is, there's no profession that we're necessarily bidden to refrain from, to stay away from. Every single profession presents its own set of pitfalls. A doctor, if a doctor isn't sufficiently conscientious and careful, so patients can die. One has to know. They can't be a mediocre doctor. I remember I had a friend in college who was debating as to whether he should be going to medical school or to law school. And he said, parents always wanted him to be a doctor, so he felt that he needed to go to medical school, but the truth of the matter is his heart wasn't in it, and he didn't think that he was really going to ever be passionate about becoming a doctor, so now he was thinking about going to law school, even though his heart wasn't really in that either. So he said, better to be a mediocre lawyer than a mediocre doctor. At least people aren't going to die. So we know that that's a possible pitfall with being a doctor. Being a rabbi, if somebody goes into the rabbinate in order to make a name for himself, in order to, as the Mishnah says elsewhere, to put a crown upon their head, that they want everybody to bow down to them and everybody to give them the highest honor, and this is their sole motivation, so that's Saneat HaRabbanut. One's not supposed to go into the rabbinate for selfish motivation, so just be serving themselves, they won't be serving their congregants. But somebody who goes in for unselfish reasons, for idealistic reasons, so like Rabbi Engel, to really serve a congregation and to really be able to uplift the people. So then, that's one of the greatest. It's a mitzvah rabbah. It's a great mitzvah to become a rabbi. Same thing with respect to a lawyer. What is a lawyer? A lawyer is somebody who provides counsel to individuals who are going through situations in their lives in order to be able to assist them to better and best be able to go through those situations in the most legal, legitimate, and effective manner. That could be a tremendous help. It could be a tremendous mitzvah, the mitzvah lahatzil ashuk miyadoshko, to help somebody who's oppressed, who doesn't know what they're doing, they're getting beaten up by others, getting beaten up by the bureaucracy, to be able to help such a person navigate their way in life. It could be a tremendous mitzvah. But at the same time, if a lawyer, in fact, goes into the profession with the mindset that they're going to commit all kinds of shenanigans in order to hurt others, in order to take advantage of the weak, in order to engage in exploitation, so that, by the same token, what the Mishnah, I believe, is saying is to be a certain type of lawyer. To be the type of lawyer where you do not sufficiently discern between when you are really being helpful and when you're doing good for society and when you're really actually playing a destructive role. So that's something that you have to stay away from. What are the practical manifestations of this? Very interesting. Take a look at the Gemara, it's passage number 4 on the sheet. Gemara in Ksubas talks about the following situation. It's about a situation where there was a widow. It's a widow. And the widow had been married to a particular man. That man had children. Now, presumably, the widow, the way the story reads, probably wasn't the mother of the children. It's probably a second wife. But the children of the husband now inherited the estate. But there was a debt upon the estate. And the debt upon the estate was that, according to Jewish law, when a man dies and he leaves behind the widow, so the widow gets to collect a certain amount of the estate that's called the ketubah. Most of you are familiar with Jewish weddings. You go to Jewish wedding. So one of the highlights of the Jewish wedding is that after the husband places the ring upon the groom places the ring upon the bride's finger, so then somebody gets up, a distinguished rabbi, and reads the ketubah. And they read it very quickly, and it's in Aramaic, and nobody has any idea what the ketubah says. But part of what the ketubah says is that if the man dies, so then the wife gets to collect a certain amount of money as the ketubah payment. And people used to take this very seriously. So it happens that the widow here was entitled to the ketubah payment. Once she would receive a ketubah payment, that's it. There would be no further obligations upon the heirs of the deceased, of her late husband. But there happens to be a rule that until such time as she would receive the payment of the ketubah, they have other obligations towards her. One obligation is that if she was sick, then they would be obligated to pay for her medical expenses. Health insurance, big issue. So here was one way Jewish law addressed the health insurance issue, which is that the father's estate was responsible to pay for the health insurance for the health of the widow. But this widow had very substantial health costs, very substantial medical expenses, and it seems pretty much every single day she needed more medical expenses and so forth for her condition, and it was just going on forever. And this was in addition to the ketubah payment that needed to be paid to her. So the heirs were getting exasperated because it was depleting all the assets. They was using up so much of the money of the estate. They didn't want to pay all this money. They wanted to get out of it because they would have to continue to pay her forever her health costs. And because she had not collected the ketubah, so they still had that obligation hanging over them as well. And this was just going to go on forever. So they came to complain to Rabbi Yochanan. And Rabbi Yochanan happened to be a relative of theirs. So Rabbi Yochanan felt right to help out a relative. So Rabbi Yochanan said, I have a great idea for you, which is that there's a Jewish law principle when it comes to the laws of ketubah that says that when it comes to medical expenses, if you have a fixed cost, if you're able to go to the medical provider and get from the medical provider some sort of fixed cost where they say, if you pay this sum of money, this will cover all of her medical expenses in perpetuity, and you're able to identify such a cost, and you figure it out actuarially, however you figure it out, then a fixed medical cost would count as paying the ketubah. So once you would pay that amount, you'd be off the hook, and you wouldn't have to pay any future amounts, and you won't have to pay her health insurance in perpetuity, and you won't have the additional debt of the ketubah. And they said, wow, that's a great idea. And then Rabbi Yochanan, after giving this wonderful suggestion, said, I shouldn't have done that. I should not have given them that suggestion. Why shouldn't I have given them that suggestion? So he quoted the Mishnah. He said, Asinu Atzmenu. He said, what did I do to myself? I said, what I did in this case is, Asinu Atzmenu Ko'achay Adayonim. I've made myself like a lawyer. What I just did was I gave lawyerly advice. I gave lawyerly advice. Now the widow is not going to be able to get the medical expenses in perpetuity. Once the fixed amount is finished, that's the end. She won't be able to get an additional ketubah in addition to that. He has decreased the total amount that she is most likely eligible to receive. And I should not have engaged in that practice because I should not have made myself like a lawyer. So if it's so clear, you're not supposed to be a lawyer. So why did he do it to begin with? He's Rabbi Yochanan. He's a great rabbi. He's a great Talmudic scholar. Presumably he should know what's proper to do and what's improper to do. So really, one's not supposed to be a lawyer, period. So he shouldn't have done this to begin with. He shouldn't have thought of this. So the Gemara says, what was his original thinking? So his original thinking was that there's a mitzvah, mibsarcha lo tisalim. It's a principle, a biblical principle. One is not supposed to neglect the needs of a family member. These were family members, so he felt he had an obligation to help out the family members. So then, okay, if that's a proper justification, he's supposed to help out family members. So why then did he have chalata? Why did he have regrets? Why did he regret it afterwards? So the Gemara says he regretted it afterwards because Adam Chashuv Shaini. Because he was an Adam Chashuv, he was an important person. He represented something. He represented the Torah. He represented what the values of his people were all about. And for somebody who was a representation of Torah, somebody of the stature, of the rabbinic stature of Rabbi Yochanan, so it was improper for Rabbi Yochanan to engage in this type of activity. Mara has a similar story with respect to the great sage of Nachman. Nachman also had a relative who was in a jam. She was a woman who inherited an estate from her parents. Her father had died, so her mother was entitled to the ketubah. Then the mother died before she collected anything, but as a result, the daughter got the entire estate. There were no sons, so the daughter got the entire estate. It turned out that the mother, during her lifetime, had sold the rights to her ketubah. So now, the people, you could do that. You can sell the rights to the ketubah. In the event that the mother would either be divorced or the husband would predecease her, she would be entitled to the ketubah. And in the event that she would die first, so then she wouldn't be entitled to the ketubah. So in this case, what happened? The husband divorced her. And then the mother was supposed to receive the ketubah. The mother did not receive the ketubah because she died. Now the daughter is the heir of the mother, and the people who bought the rights to the ketubah say, your mother was entitled to the ketubah because the husband divorced, so we want to collect the ketubah. So that would have taken a nice chunk out of the estate. She would have had to pay the ketubah. So there's a rule. That is, that the wife can say to the husband, you are obligated to pay me the ketubah, but you know what? I forgive the debt. And once she forgives the debt, so then the debt is forgiven. Even if she sold the debt to somebody else, the debt would be forgiven. The people who bought it would lose their right to collect it to the ketubah because she retains her right to forgive the debt even after she sells it. So Rabbi Nachman advised his relative, saying, no, just like your mother could have forgiven the debt, you could forgive the debt. So you forgive the debt. Once you forgive the debt, then there's no longer a ketubah for them to collect. All you have is the estate. The estate includes everything in it, okay? And therefore, you won't have to pay that amount of money, and you'll be off the hook. So if Nachman had the same conversation with himself, first he gave the advice, and he said, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Asino atzmenu ke'ochei adayonin. I made myself like a lawyer. As a result, these other purchasers of the ketubah who paid good money to purchase the rights to the ketubah, now they've lost out. They're not able to collect the ketubah, and it's all because of my advice, and I shouldn't have done it. Why did he do it originally? Because it was a family member. And why did he feel bad about it afterwards? Because he was an Adam Chashuv, because he was an important person. So the question becomes the following. Let's say that you're not an important person. Okay? Let's say you're not a rabbinic leader of the generation like Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Nachman. Would it have been impermissible for somebody who was not an important person to render this type of advice? Or is it only because they were an Adam Chashuv, because they were an important person, and that's why they were not supposed to render this type of lawyerly advice? And if, in fact, we say that somebody who's not a really important rabbinic personality can render this type of advice, do they have to be a relative? Because these are cases where they said, I thought it was okay because I was a relative. So here we have a dispute, interestingly enough, between contemporary rabbinic authorities. The one authority named the Bach says that even for somebody who's not an important rabbinic personality, well, contemporary, okay, 400 years ago, but still, you know, the post-Talmudic. So the Bach says that even if somebody is not an Adam Chashuv, they're not an important rabbinic personality, we still have a requirement if they're going to act like a lawyer like this, they have to be a relative. While the Tosfos Yomtov, another authority, commentary on the Mishnah, says no, if you're not an Adam Chashuv, then you could be anybody, even if you're not a relative, it's okay to be a lawyer. Says the Piskei Tshuva, one of the great, much more contemporary poskim rabbinic law authorities, quoting this dispute between the Bach and the Tosfos Yomtov. He says the simple reading and the simple understanding of most commentaries is like the Bach, that if you're not a relative, you don't get off the ground. The only reason why these cases got off the ground in the case of Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Nachman is because they were dealing with relatives. But if you're not dealing with relatives, you have no business giving them lawyerly advice. It sounds like there's a real problem being a lawyer. But at the same time, there's a third passage in the Gemara in Kesubos that doesn't indicate any problem whatsoever. What's the third passage? The third passage, which I don't think I have here in the material, so I'll just say it, I'll read it from the text. This is a Gemara, Talmudic passage in Kesubos and Daf, on Nundal and Beis, 54b. It says that there was another relative of Rabbi Yochanan, and they had a stepmother, another stepmother case, and she was eating everything in sight. She was eating basically all of the food, all the assets of the estate, because she had a very hearty appetite. So they came in front of Rabbi Yochanan and they said, she's eating us out of house and home. There's not going to be anything left. What are we going to do? So Rabbi Yochanan said, you know what? When it comes time for the stepfather to, the father, when it comes time for the father to bequeath his final assets, and he has to leave something for the stepmother, if he doesn't say anything, she's just going to, after he dies, she's just going to eat up the entire estate, because she can say, I want to be fed from the estate, and therefore they'll lose everything. So you'll set aside a specific piece of property and say you can only collect from this property. You need to sell the property to get your whatever assets, money you need, you'll sell the property, but that's it. I'm just going to set aside a specific designated piece of property, and that way you'll have everything else. They said, that's a great idea. And the Gemara doesn't indicate that there was any problem in his rendering this type of advice. It doesn't say he said, oh, I regret having done that, I acted like a lawyer. Doesn't nothing, no problem whatsoever. So the Tosfos commentary on that Gemara says, why was there no problem with this? We just said that there's a problem being a lawyer. We were already going to look for other professions. We were already going to decide that if you hold like the Bach, that unless you're helping out a relative, you can't be a lawyer at all. So why in this particular Gemara is it not a problem? So Tosfos says this wasn't a problem because kiven de bedaita taloi im tirtze lekabel, because it was up to her whether she was going to accept this deal. Meaning in the other cases that we were dealing with, the party who was losing out had no say in the matter. The party who was losing out was basically disadvantaged. In case of the widow who needed the medical help, there was nothing that she could do. If the relatives would have gone to a doctor and stipulated a specific amount, she would have been stuck. In the case of the purchasers of the ketubah rights, if the ketubah would have been waived and forgiven, there's nothing they could have done. They couldn't have protested the sale. It wasn't in their hands to prevent the waiver. But in this particular case, this was a negotiated deal that was going to take place between the relatives and the wife, in which they would say, look, We need to be able to subsist. You need to be able to eat. But if we don't set aside particular property, we're going to lose out. It's not going to be fair. On the other hand, if we set aside property, it should be ample for you. It should be enough for you. This way, we win, you win. It's reasonable. It's fair. It's nice. What do you say? That you go along with it? And she would say yes. And only under those circumstances would we go along with it. And would it be okay? And the Mishnah seems to indicate that would not be, the Gemara seems to indicate that would not be, that would not be a problem. So what we see is that there are different types of lawyerly interventions that are described by the Gemara, some which are viewed as problematic, and some which are viewed as not problematic at all. In fact, in the case of the woman who was eating from the estate, the Me'iri says, the commentator, the Me'iri says, she was eating too much. She was objectively eating too much, meaning that there was an injustice that was being perpetrated against the family members. And says the Maharshal, famous commentator Maharshal, whenever there is some sort of injustice that's being perpetrated and you have to rescue people from being taken advantage of themselves, from being exploited themselves, so then it is laudable for somebody to insert themselves into the process in order to give good, sound, legal advice, in order to extricate themselves from their dilemma. And that is considered to be a mitzvah type of intervention and an appropriate professional role for a lawyer according to the Jewish tradition. So we see that when the Mishnah says, Al tas atzmecha, ka'orchei adayonim, don't make yourself like a lawyer, it could very well be the Mishnah is saying, be careful. If you're going to be a lawyer, be careful. Be careful to try to emulate the ideals that are expressed by the Maharshal, by the Tosfos, by the last Gemara that we quoted, of helping somebody who is being taken advantage of facilitating an arm's length negotiation between parties where you're not taking advantage of a disadvantaged party. But when in fact the advice is such that if things left alone, there would basically be a situation of justice. Like in the case, the first case, there would have been a situation of justice. A woman in need of medical care would have received her medical care. Then it's under many circumstances, unless we're dealing with a close relative who, you know, might be considered to be appropriately involved anyway, but to insert oneself into that type of situation to bring about a disadvantage for somebody else, that's something that one has to be very wary about. Sometimes this type of thing comes up in the context of transactions where you're negotiating with a party, where maybe the other party is perhaps a little bit less experienced or a little bit less savvy, and they may not notice certain things that you might be doing. This was a question that lawyers raise I think is probably answered differently by different attorneys. You're involved in a transaction, and there's a very important term that you want to insert that will have very favorable implications for your client and very unfavorable implications for the other person's client. And, you know, you go through different rounds of drafting documents, you go through your black lines or whatever, and you change a provision the way it was drafted, and you change it in order to make it more favorable for yourself and more unfavorable for the other party. And it's black line, so presumably the other lawyer should see it, but you know, you black line 50 different things. And maybe you discuss a whole bunch of them so they know to look for the other things. This one you didn't discuss. You just kind of throw it in there. So you have an obligation to point it out to the other attorney and say, look, I made this change. I made this change, which, you know, you don't have to necessarily go through all the potential ramifications, but it used to be that the provision said such and such, but now you should really focus on the fact that it says such and such, and the basic meaning should be explained. My opinion, from a Jewish ethical perspective, one has an obligation at least of pointing out this type of thing to the other party. Now, it could be that the other party won't have necessarily all of the foresight to think of every single ramification that might occur, or may not care about every single ramification. You're not obligated to lawyer the deal, to be the lawyer of the deal for the other party, but at least to flag the issue so that they have the opportunity to think it through and consult with whomever they need to consult That seems to me to be warranted and appropriate along the lines of what Tosos discusses, of why was there no problem in the case where they wanted to set aside a piece of real estate for this one particular designated asset for this widow who was eating from the estate, because it was something that was going to be negotiated with her. It was something where there was going to be a knowing transaction that took place in which everybody understood what was at stake, everybody understood the consequences, and there was a fair deal that was negotiated. Reminds me of even I was involved in one transaction where I remember at the closing, one of the sides, you know, you put all the pages basically in the different binders or in the different folders at the closing table, and one of the lawyers for the other side realized that they drafted something not quite the way that they had intended to draft it. And they made the changes, and while nobody was looking, they slipped the pages in the middle of the document, wherever it was, page 40, whatever it was in the middle of the document. They took out the page that was there and they put in the page as they had just changed it, because they reasoned to themselves that this was really fair. It's just that they, you know, didn't pick up that they needed to make a particular change. This type of approach in which there isn't information sharing with the other party, where you're exploiting another party, you're taking advantage of somebody being blindsided. So this is objectively unethical. I think that this is a principle that is being expressed in some fashion when you take the totality of all of these various sources and you think of them together of what exactly is being conveyed. My general approach when I practiced law was I tried to have a reasonably respectful relationship with the attorneys for the other side. I was a transactional lawyer for the most part. I was a commercial real estate attorney. Often dealt with very, very big transactions. I remember when I first started the practice of law, when I was a summer associate, so my first shocking experience was when I was sitting in a negotiating conference and somebody, one of the lawyers, blurted out this. They were arguing over one detail. I said, oh, what's the big deal? It's only $1 million. So that was kind of like kind of taken aback. But then I remember that, you know, what really blew me away was several years later when I was already a mid-level associate and I was negotiating some deal with some, you know, giant, you know, multi-billion dollar deal. And somebody at the in the final negotiating conferences, you know, happened to just make an offhand comment as we were negotiating a point, saying, yeah, it's not such a big deal, it's only $1 billion. So sometimes you're dealing with huge stakes in this particular business. Sometimes I would notice something that appeared detrimental to the other side that I didn't think the other side necessarily picked up upon. I would generally point it out, and then if they felt that it's something they could live with, so it's fine. I was happy that they were able to live with it, but I felt that it was important that they at least had flagged exactly what a provision was saying, that they should understand if we drafted something a particular way, what the import of the provision was. You shouldn't try to be sneaky and to blindside the other side of a transaction. I think that is an actual, genuine Jewish legal ethic. When it comes to the practice of law, the other side of the role of the attorney, from the standpoint of Jewish law, which runs, I think, somewhat in tension to the role of the attorney from the perspective of civil law, is in the role of the attorney during a trial itself, when one appears before the judge, when appears in a court. What is the role of an attorney in such a case? So it's very interesting that some of the commentators on the Mishnah that talks about how one should not be ka'orchei hadayanim, one should not be like an attorney. So some of the commentators say that this is talking about those people who are kind of whispering to the dayanim, the whispering to the judges in the course of an actual trial, that they're presenting, trying to figure out how to present the case of their client in the most advantageous fashion before the judge, that this is somehow something which is frowned upon. So this would be, I think, from an American law perspective, this would be zealous, responsible advocacy, that if you find some sort of loophole in the law that happens to benefit your client, then you have an obligation to present it to the judge. But from the perspective of Jewish law, no, you're supposed to stay out of it altogether. Many authorities would go so far as to say you shouldn't have lawyers presenting the case. They should be only presented by the sides, by the parties themselves. There's a principle in Jewish law that the one is supposed to hear directly from the party and not from an interpreter, not from a translator, not from an intermediary. You got to hear the case from the party, from the party herself or the party himself. So what then would be the justification, according to Jewish law, for the presence of lawyers in a courtroom? So the Rambam talks about this. The famous commentator, famous Jewish law authority, 12th century, the Rambam, the laws of Sanhedrin, the Rambam says, you have two militating principles here, two opposing principles that kind of operate in a dialectical tension. One is the notion of not skewering a case or perverting the facts or encouraging a party to pervert the facts before a judge just to win and to obtain an unjust result. And the other is a principle which is called psach picha le'ile. What's psach picha le'ile? Psach picha le'ile means that you're supposed to enable somebody who's mute. Ile means they're mute. You're supposed to open up their mouths. There's a mitzvah of opening up the mouths of somebody who is mute, who's not able to adequately express themselves. And the Rambam says that initially, at least the way that a Jewish court of justice would work, which is a much more active type of court, where the court serves a much more inquisitorial type of role, this was actually the responsibility of the judges themselves. That if a judge would see that a party had difficulty expressing their claims and expressing their situation, they weren't being coherent, they weren't being clear, then it was actually the responsibility of a judge under those circumstances to act ke'ochei ha'dayan, to act as a lawyer for the party, to be the advocate, to be the protagonist of that party in the court proceeding, just in order to enable justice to be served. The person shouldn't have to suffer because they couldn't express themselves well. So Rambam says that a judge always has to balance this tension between, on the one hand, not skewering a case by kind of coaching a party, which is also included in what the Mishnah says, don't make yourself like a lawyer, the judge shouldn't make himself like a lawyer, and at the same time, being sensitive to psach picha le'ilein, to the principle of enabling those without a mouth to be properly heard and for their claims to be properly expressed. And says the Rambam, Sarakles Yashay Bedovize Harbe, one has to be extremely careful, extremely meticulous about maintaining this very fine distinction between these two opposing principles. And in a Besdin type of setting, in a Jewish law court type of setting, this is very much the tension that's always at play between allowing for parties to bring in, say, rabbinic advocates to present the case, because Jewish law, on some fundamental level, frowns upon this type of practice based on many factors, including the concern that the rabbinic law advocates may try to skewer the case towards what might be an unjust result. At the same time, it's also important to make sure the parties have the ability to express themselves, which is why, if you take, for example, the example of the Beis Din of America, there is always a very strong commitment to allow and even encourage attorneys to be brought into the process, because the attorneys, the licensed attorneys, besides the fact that there is a tremendous benefit of not worrying about them, hopefully, not worrying unduly about them skewering the truth, because they do have, in fact, an obligation to adhere to the rules of professional responsibility. Whether you call those objectively ethical or not rules, those are professional rules of responsibility. The good thing about lawyers is that lawyers can be so nasty that as nasty as one lawyer is, the lawyer has to worry about the other lawyer being equally nasty, and therefore if they're going to violate one of the rules of professional responsibility, they have to assume that the other lawyer is going to take them to task for it, and they could lose their professional license. So there is that advantage, which at least in this country, rabbinic advocates are not subject to any kind of disciplinary board. But in addition, the primary role that really is served by the attorneys in the process is precisely this principle of psach picha l'ile, of giving a voice to those who are not able otherwise to adequately express themselves. You have somebody who's just not able to figure out how to organize their materials. Somebody who's not able to figure out how to express themselves in a way which sounds sympathetic or which sounds credible. There's somebody who's not able to figure out how to take the facts and how to express what it is, what remedies they're looking for in a particular situation. And what an attorney's role is, ideally, from the standpoint of halacha, is to enable the presentation to be clear, cogent, and organized so that the judge will be able to adequately assess the validity of the claims and be able to issue a just verdict under the circumstances. In the American system of justice, which is dependent not as much on an inquisitorial system, like the Jewish version of the court system, where the dayanim, the judges, play a much more active role, it becomes that much more imperative for the lawyers to play an active role in terms of the presentation of the case. So what I say, really, in response to those who ask, oh, is it possible for an ethical Jew to be a lawyer? My response is, if a person is really talented in the direction of being a lawyer, and a person really has the ability to contribute and to make a meaningful difference in terms of righting wrongs and in terms of being able to help somebody express their valid claims so that a just verdict can be rendered. If they deserve to win, then they'll win. If they don't deserve to win, then they don't deserve to win. Then the answer is, if somebody really does have this skill set and somebody does have those inclinations, then the ethical thing to do is precisely to become a lawyer. Because then it becomes one's obligation to use their talents in order to be able to better serve society and to be able to ensure just results in the legal process. And after all, the legal process is of fundamental importance from a Jewish, from a Torah perspective, where so much of our religious principles revolve around ensuring that there be a just legal system. So can an ethical Jew be a lawyer? Absolutely. In fact, an ethical Jew who is so inclined probably must be a lawyer, but must be a lawyer under the guidelines of basic ethical principles and basic ethical aspirations that we have outlined, at least briefly, in our presentation. There's so much more, obviously, that can be discussed and should be discussed from a Jewish legal perspective in terms of the various pitfalls that attorneys face and the various challenges and the different types of attorneys and so forth. But in the brief time that we have today, I just wanted to give you this basic overview to appreciate that the Talmudic sources that we have can actually be of relevance in terms of our contemporary practice. Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to thank Rabbi Reese. We're going to take a 4-minute pause now in the program, but Professor Reznikov is going to explain to all of those who are here.